everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we've got the second of our special episodes focusing on this year's Philip Carnegie Medal. Jason Reynolds reveals the real-life tragedy that inspired Long Way Down.
I just remember being a young person full of anger and rage and not knowing what we're supposed to do about this situation, and the way that we were raised in sort of our neighborhoods sort of backed us up against a wall because those rules were very real for us.
Sally Nichols discusses Things a Bright Girl Can Do.
It's about what happened to the suffrage movement when the First World War happened, and it's also two love stories, one gay and one straight.
And Candy Gourlay reimagines the US conquest of the Philippines in Bone Talk. That's all coming up in today's Read On. But first, some sad news about one of our favourite talking book narrators.
A very familiar voice to all talking book users, Stephen Thorne, has died at the age of 84. He was an actor whose 60-year career was dominated by vocal work, notably as a regular performer on BBC Radio. In over 2,000 broadcasts, he played everything from Inspector Lestrade, Treebeard in Lord of the Rings, Aslan in the Narnia stories, and Fred Colon and Death in Terry Pratchett's Guards, Guards. He was also a regular on Book at Bedtime and Poetry Please. He also appeared on TV in Last of the Summer Wine, Death of an Expert Witness, and David Copperfield, but he'll be fondly remembered for his villainous stints on Doctor Who. He was Azal in the Jon Pertwee adventure The Demons, and Orgon in Frontier in Space, and when Pertwee was reunited with two predecessors, Patrick Troughton and William Hartnell, in the 10th anniversary tale The Three Doctors, a formidable foe was required. It's called Omega, and again, played by Thorne. It was in the world of audiobooks, though, that he arguably shone the brightest, with hundreds and hundreds of commercial and RNIB recordings to his name. He read every Brother Cadfael story, unabridged readings of Thomas Hardy and Charles Dickens, thrillers, detective fiction, political biographies, and even an Agatha Christie.
England. England after many years. How was he going to like it? Luke Fitzwilliam asked himself that question as he walked down the gangplank to the dock. It was present at the back of his mind all through the wait in the customs shed. It came suddenly to the fore when he was finally seated in the boat train. England on leave was one thing, plenty of money to blue, to begin with anyway. Old friends to look up, meetings with other fellows, home like himself. A carefree atmosphere of, well, it won't be long, might as well enjoy myself, soon be going back. But now there was no question of going back. No more of the hot, stifling nights, no more blinding sun and tropical beauty of rich vegetation. No more lonely evenings reading and rereading old copies of the Times. Here he was, honourably retired on a pension, with some small private means of his own, a gentleman of leisure, come home to England. What was he going to do with himself?
Stephen Thorne reading Murder is Easy by Agatha Christie. Tributes to Stephen poured in from people such as Mark Gatiss and Doctor Who co-star Katie Manning, from places like the Story Circle and Isis Audiobooks, and from many audiobook narrators and producers who had the pleasure of working with him. Producer Ross Berman said, "Sad, sad news. A great man, exceptional reader and Kit Kat sharer. I grew up listening to his voice and later had the honour to record it." Narrator David Thorpe added, "The heavens have gained a new voice, and what a voice. Passionate, hilarious, talented, modest, supportive, wonderful actor and man. I'm sure they had the champagne on ice for you up there." Now that's a reference to the glass of bubbly Stephen would have after completing a book. "Personally, I had the pleasure of working with him in the RNIB Talking Book Studios and had the opportunity to thank him for his reading of McCarthy's Bar, which I'd very recently listened to." To which he replied, "Oh, I can only apologise."
Now, if you're going to go travelling in Ireland, it's important to know the correct way to ask somebody for directions. What you don't do is abruptly say, "Excuse me, could you tell me the way to..." This is an English technique, the subtext of which is, "I'm interrupting you here in a fairly clumsy way in order to elicit a necessary fact, but otherwise this transaction is of no value and will give no pleasure. Go on, tell me then." The preferred approach in Ireland is to turn the encounter into a social occasion, on a par with what goes on when two strangers meet and get chatting at a party or wedding reception. A tangential preamble is essential, something along the lines of, "Ah, that's a great hedge you're trimming," or, "Sure, it's a glorious day," especially if it isn't. Large quantities of personal information will then be exchanged, in the course of which the directions you are seeking may or may not emerge. Some of the best conversations you will have in Ireland may happen in this way.
Stephen Thorne reading McCarthy's Bar by Pete McCarthy. Although it was fiction he mainly recorded, he did add voice to one of my personal favourites, Dear Robert, Dear Spike, the Graves Milligan correspondence. The letters exchanged between unlikely friends, Robert Graves and Spike Milligan.
The starting point was Robert Graves's guest appearance on a TV programme, Muses with Milligan. A typical trite BBC title. Nevertheless, it started a really delightful, for me, friendship. Prior to the correspondence, we ate at the Matalo, over wine, which he loved. I was almost entranced with his great, ranging conversations. The common bonding of our friendship was his mischievous, iconoclastic perorations on all stratas of stupidity or unreasonableness. Of the latter, seeing a disgruntled author at a party, "That's Kingsley Amis, and there's no known cure." He would make a brief statement which almost meant nothing. It was the nuance in the voice, i.e., at a post-TV show drinky-poos, his intense blue eyes homed in on a very noisy, whiskey-swigging BBC pro. As the dolt left the room, Robert said very slowly, "I wonder if he knows." To the correspondence, in writing to him, it couldn't be an ordinary letter. No, I realised with him, I would have to raise my game. For the first time in my life, I wrote letters as meaningful as my sensibilities would allow. His letters in return didn't have to dig as deep. He wasn't writing to an Olympian. I was. That my letters would one day be published alongside his, to me, has a touch of the Tooth Fairy.
Stephen Thorne reading from Dear Robert, Dear Spike. All the books featured, and indeed many, many more narrated by Stephen, are available from RNIB Library. Multi-award-winning actor and narrator Stephen Thorne, who has died at the age of 84.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
The Carnegie Medal is the UK's oldest prize for children's literature. Founded in 1936, its list of winners includes some of the best-known and most loved authors writing in the English language. The organisers, CILIP, the Library and Information Association, work closely with RNIB to ensure that all the books on the shortlist are made fully accessible. And a group of VI pupils from New College Worcester is among the many children who shadow the selection of the winner. This year, 8 titles are in contention, and, as usual, Read On was keen to interview as many of their authors as possible. First up, Jason Reynolds is passionate about getting young people reading, and, though his background is unusual for a writer, It's what connects him with teenagers. He's a best-selling author at home in the United States, and his novel Long Way Down has won him a UK audience, and it's been shortlisted for this year's Carnegie Medal.
Don't nobody believe nothing these days, which is why I haven't told nobody the story I'm about to tell you. And truth is, you probably ain't gonna believe it either. Gonna think I'm lying or I'm losing it, but I'm telling you, this story is true. It happened to me. Really. It did. It so did. My name is Will. William. William Holloman. But to my friends and people who know me, just Will. So call me Will, because after I tell you what I'm about to tell you, you'll either want to be my friend or not want to be my friend at all. Either way, you'll know me. I'm only William to my mother and my brother Sean whenever he was trying to be funny. Now I'm wishing I would have laughed more at his dumb jokes, because the day before yesterday, Sean was shot and killed.
He joined me via Skype from Washington, D.C.
Jason Reynolds, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give the listeners an outline of Long Way Down?
Sure. I mean, Long Way Down is, it's actually a really simple concept. It's the this idea that there's a young man whose brother has been murdered, unfortunately. And shortly after his brother's death, he is sort of tasked with either following the rules or not following the rules. And what do I mean by the rules? Well, in the community that he's growing up in, there are three rules that everybody's expected to follow. It's no crying, no snitching, and you always seek revenge. And so this young man who's 15 years old gets on an elevator. 85% of the book takes place on that elevator. It takes place over the course of about 60 seconds of his life. And on each floor of the elevator, as he's going from the eighth floor down to the ground floor, every time he gets on that elevator, somebody new gets on every floor. And he has to sort of face them and have a conversation. And the hard part about this is that he knows the people who step on that elevator, but he also knows that they are all no longer alive.
Wow. And this book was actually inspired by something that happened to you when you were 19 years old.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was 19, I lost a friend. One of my good buddies was killed. And I just remember being a young person full of anger and rage and not knowing what we're supposed to do about this situation. And the way that we were raised in sort of our neighborhoods sort of backed us up against a wall, because those rules were very real for us. We had our own ecosystem in the way that we sort of governed our neighborhoods, mainly because we didn't believe that police officers would even try to solve the case. So you kind of had to take matters into your own hands a lot of times. At least it felt like you did. And I wanted to write a book that didn't just push kids into sort of thinking about the decisions that they make, but that also honored young people's human anger, right? That rage is a very real thing that so many kids feel, but we never talk about it. We're so afraid to address and to acknowledge the fact that young people and older people, adults as well, have a real warranted and human anger that sometimes metastasizes and shows itself in toxic ways.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, disabled people completely understand that, the rage and frustration at feeling powerlessness. Mm. And it can take you to some very unpleasant places. Clearly, you didn't go out and avenge your friend's murder. What was it that stopped you?
His mother. You know, we were going to go out and avenge his murder, but his mother begged us to let it go. And so we let it go. You know, we had enough respect for his mom. You know, I remember her blocking the door and saying, well, no other mothers need to feel what I'm feeling, right? And so we decided that we would respect that. And so we let it go. And I'm glad we did. It's interesting because it's one of those things where you feel like you're frozen in a block of ice, and it feels like time is standing still, and that you're going to feel that way forever. But if you could just give it a moment, the ice slowly starts to melt. Now, it doesn't mean that it's any less painful, but it does mean that the rage part of it, right, starts to die down a bit. You're still angry, but the rage tends to ebb a bit if you give it a chance. And I think that's sort of, you know, fortunately, she was able to put a pin in it long enough to get us to kind of deflate for a moment, which probably saved my life.
And I guess that the ghosts that visit Will in the elevator on the way down, his friend Buck and the little girl Dina, who was shot dead by accident when she was eight. They give him that perspective the same way as your friend's mum did.
Sure, for sure. I mean, they give him that perspective without sort of beating him over the head with it. Like, my friend's mom didn't tell us, you know, it wasn't like she made us feel bad about the way we were feeling. She just asked us to think about the fact that she didn't want anybody else to have to feel that pain. But she never dismissed our anger and our pain. And so I think Buck and everybody in that elevator, they're not necessarily trying to talk him out of it. They're just asking him some questions. They're trying to get him to come to his own conclusion, and trying to get him to sort of work through his feelings and what's going on at this particular moment, not to sway him either way per se, but to get him to come to the conclusion, to see a little more clearly, just by presenting themselves, right? By crowding into an elevator saying, like, make sure you look around and see what you're standing in the midst of, right? Like, this is what this looks like on the other side. And I think that's something that it was like a moment of clarity for us. And I won't say if it was a moment of clarity for Will or not, you know?
No spoilers on this show. No. Now, you as an author are famous at being able to reach the audience that many other writers cannot reach, because you are from the same background as a lot of the kids you are communicating with. I read somewhere that you didn't actually read your first book from end to end until you were 17. Firstly, what was the book? And secondly, what did that teach you about making books accessible to young lads who would prefer not to be reading?
The book was a book by Richard Wright called Black Boy, which I love. I still love it. It was a wonderful book. And what it taught me was that you don't need 50 pages of exposition. And that... Perhaps the formatting of novels, you know, that there's no one way to format a novel and to tell a story, that it doesn't have to be this really slow walk up the hill to get to the conflict, which is supposed to be this massive payoff, right? What if we could sort of reformat the paradigm of novel writing and say, like, or we could just put the explosion at the beginning, right? Because it wasn't that I didn't like to read, it's that I didn't like to be bored and I didn't have the patience to get to the good stuff. Or to like take the gamble that there would be good stuff after 50, 60, 70 pages, because what if there wasn't? And I'd wasted so much time. And I know we live in a world where everybody is like, well, we need to be sort of helping young people develop a certain kind of discipline in that way. But I honestly believe it's a lot to ask, because most adults don't even want to give a book 50, 60 pages of a slog before you get to the good part. I think we're asking of them more than we ever even ask of ourselves most of the time. And so in a world that is moving at a 60-second clip, and a world that is sort of inundated with social media and video games, cell phones, and internet, and YouTube, I don't try to work against those things. I try to work with them, right? If they've got a minute and a half time span, because their YouTube videos are a minute and a half, then I'm going to give them a minute and a half before we get to the good stuff in the book. And then after I get them, we can walk it back. And we can start again, and we can sort of add in all the other elements to build out this sort of tale, because I got them already, right? You have to. I think it's there's no other part of our lives with young people that we don't try to figure out how to hook them. There's nothing else. Every other part of our lives, any other engagement that we have with young people, we know for it's the reason we do icebreakers when we meet them in schools. It's the reason we know that you literally have a minute and a half before you lose them. So why in books don't we think about it the same way? That's all.
The book is written in verse, and is writing in verse part of that attraction?
I think it's definitely a big part of it. I mean, the other thing about that book and about, so after you get them, you hook them. I think the other part for me was that for this particular novel, I needed it to be to move at a certain pace. Right. So I couldn't try to convince some teenager that a book that takes place in 60 seconds really takes place in 60 seconds if it took that kid a month to read the book. So that was the first thing. I needed to make sure it made sense in terms of the time scope. And then the other part of it was I knew that seeing 15 words on the page would eliminate the intimidation of reading. Reading, if you aren't a reader, can be intimidating to see 500 words on a page. It could just be intimidating. Like, that's just the reality. And so I wanted to do away with all those things and let this be the first book that a lot of these young folks can actually get through, simply because you can knock it out in 45 minutes to an hour. And there is an amazing euphoric experience when it comes to turning pages. And that I needed to make sure they kept turning pages, because turning pages feels good physiologically and psychologically, you know.
Is there going to be an audiobook version of it for those of us who can't read print? And if so, would you consider reading it yourself?
There is an audio version over here. I'm not sure if it's the audio versions go across, if they go across the pond or not. I'm not sure how that works, but there is an audio version, so maybe you can get it. And it's me reading it. I'm reading it.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, in which case, I shall try and get a US import copy. And it was important for you to narrate it yourself, was it?
Oh, for this one, yes. I usually never narrate my books, but this particular book, yes, because of the tricky way that it was written, only I know what it's supposed to sound like and sort of the pacing of it, what words are supposed to be accented, et cetera, et cetera. And so I had to do this one.
I think it's really interesting that you with Long Way Down and Elizabeth Acevedo with The Poet X have both chosen to write in verse in a very urban environment to allow an outlet for your teenage readers. Do you think your book appeals as much to young women and hers to young men?
I think that this book definitely appeals to young women as well. I think that young women know this pain as well. I think they've lost their brothers. Many of them have lost their fathers. They understand what this feels like. They've lost their own friends, right? Like they know what this feels like. This isn't just because I'm using a young man as my protagonist. There are many, many, many young women who know the feeling of this loss and the feeling of what to do next or what to do about this loss. And the other thing I think is that it appeals to the poet. It appeals to any young person who struggles with reading, whether you're a boy or a girl, young woman or a young man, because of the way it's written. I think it could be used. It appeals to anybody who has to make difficult decisions in life, no matter what those decisions are. It appeals to anybody who's ever been taught anything. You see the ghost on the elevator. They represent, I mean, all of us are haunted by something, right? Whether it be haunted by people we've lost, or whether it be haunted by our parents' teachings, our education, haunted by our religious practices, haunted by our neighborhoods and what we've seen, right? Haunting isn't always a bad thing, but there's always something that's lingering, whispering in your ear. That's all of us. That's a human condition. You know, we make decisions every day based on our hauntings. And I think it doesn't matter what your gender is. You know, you can relate to that.
You must be delighted you're finding an even wider audience over this side of the Atlantic, having been shortlisted for the Philip Carnegie Medal. And clearly, we might not have guns, but we do have a lot of problem with knife crime. So hopefully the book will give a lot of people pause for thought. If you are the eventual winner, what would you do with the Braille copy of Long Way Down that you will receive from the organisers, Philip?
Oh, man. I think for me, the first thing I'll do is I take it to my father's house. My grandfather was a blind man. And and I've written about him in other books. He was like a superhero to me growing up. But he never saw me. He'd never seen me because he had glaucoma and he went blind before I was born. And so I have a wide array of incredible stories with a man that I never even knew was blind, because he moved around like he wasn't. You know, he lived alone and he watched food and do all these things that I had no idea a blind man could do. And it was amazing to see. And I learned early that you could do anything you wanted to do, right? I watched a man live a full life without being able to see. And I think if I were to win and I got the Braille copy of the book, it would just be such an emotional experience for my father and I to sit and kind of look at that and think about what that means in the trajectory and the lineage of our family, being as though that has been a real part of our lives for a very, very, very long time. This has been in our lives for a very, 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 very long time. We'd probably have a good cry about it, you know.
Well, Jason Reynolds, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Best of luck with the Philip Carnegie Medal ceremony. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again on Read On.
For sure. Thank you so much, man.
The sadness is just so hard to explain. Imagine waking up and someone, a stranger, got you strapped down, got pliers shoved into your mouth, gripping a tooth somewhere in the back, one of the big important ones, and rips it out. Imagine the knocking in your head, the pressure pushing through your ears, the blood pooling. But the worst part, the absolute worst part, is the constant slipping of your tongue into the new empty space where you know a tooth supposed to be, but ain't no more. It's so hard to say Sean's dead. Sean's dead. Sean's dead. So strange to say, so sad, but I guess not surprising, which I guess is even stranger and even sadder.
Long Way Down is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later in this week's Carnegie Medal Special Edition, a clash of cultures in the Philippines in Bone Talk, but first. Things a Bright Girl Can Do is a historical novel set during the First World War. It follows three young suffragettes in their pursuit of rights for women.
Evelyn Collis was 17 years old, and despite what certain poets might have to say about it, she was finding this more of an impediment than an ornament. She was the second of four children. Her brother Christopher, known as Kit, was 19 and away at Oxford. Evelyn, though she loved her brother in a dutiful sort of way, could not help resenting the fact that he'd been given everything she had ever wanted without asking for it or even seeming to care very much when he received it. Christopher had been allowed to do everything at an earlier age than she had. He had been sent off to boarding school, something Evelyn had always secretly longed for, and now her parents were paying for a university course he didn't seem to even particularly enjoy. This was especially galling since Evelyn had discovered a desire to go to university herself, and her family had been decidedly unsympathetic.
Cassie Layton narrating Things a Bright Girl Can Do, which is TB24758. It's written by Sally Nichols, who joined me down the line from her home in Oxford. Sally Nichols, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
So, can you outline the premise of Things a Bright Girl Can Do?
Yeah, it's about three teenagers who are involved in the suffrage movement in Britain. So it opened in 1914, and they're all coming at it from very different perspectives. I have one whose dad is a stevedore, works on the docks. I've got another whose father is a civil servant, and another girl who's a Quaker's daughter. She's involved in the sort of pacifist side of the movement. And they all have very different ideas on how the best way to promote women's suffrage is. And it's about that. It's about what happens to the suffrage movement when the First World War happens. And it's also two love stories, one gay and one straight.
It's a real cross-section of Edwardian society, which allows you to explore some of the lesser-known stories of the First World War on the home front.
Yes, That was really interesting. You sort of think you've got an idea of what the First World War was like, and it wasn't until I started going away and reading lots of primary sources, accounts by women, by peacemakers, by women who lived in the East End and that sort of thing, that I realised how much of the history we're taught is rich white man's history. The story you imagine about the First World War is the young man who joins up on the first day of the war and trots off very keenly and, you know, is traumatised in the trenches. And what had never occurred to me was the working class men who were the sole wage earner of the family and what happens to them when they're called up and have to go to fight. I mean, conscription was only for unmarried men, but if you were an ex-soldier, then you were on the reservist list. So Nell, one of the characters in my book, her father is a reservist and he's called up on the first day of the war, and that's her family's income that vanishes while they're waiting for the, you know, this is an army who's increased by literally thousands of men in a couple of months. The soldiers haven't got uniforms, they haven't got shoes, they haven't got weapons. Making sure that wives and children get pay is way down the bottom of their priority list. And that's just a story that I hadn't heard. All the East End factories close because a lot of them are making products that are sold to Europe. Nell works in a jam factory, and one of their big customers is Germany, Belgium, places like that. And, of course, all the men go off and join up. So the factories just collapse. And that was something that happened to a lot of the industry in Britain, particularly as people are making boots and, and weapons and things like that. And just what chaos that threw many working-class families in. And that literally was a story that I didn't even know existed.
Did you spend weeks and weeks in the British Library and the Imperial War Museum researching? And was it difficult to leave the research and sit down and start writing?
I actually really don't like research. I'm quite unusual in that most historical writers get into this because they love the history. I get into it because I love the stories. I didn't do that level of research. I mostly concentrated on first-hand accounts of people who were there. So I read writers like Evelyn Sharp, who's quoted in the book, Sylvia Pankhurst, lots of novels. The suffragettes were great self-publicists, so they were all these suffrage novels, suffrage plays, suffrage speeches, that kind of stuff, which were really interesting because they give you a sense of the sort of arguments that people... And it's quite unexpected arguments that they're fighting. One of the big arguments seems to be that, you know, a woman doesn't need a vote because she can persuade her man to vote how she chooses using her feminine wiles, and that's the more acceptable way of doing it. I mean, that isn't an argument that would occur to people nowadays, but it crops up again and again in the literature as something people are trying to disprove, that that's not a, you know, it's not very fair to the man or the woman to ask the man to vote how you want, and that maybe feminine wiles isn't a very honest way of getting your view put across. I also read a lot of Edwardian children's books because I was really interested in how the characters speak. You know, my characters are 15 and 17 when the book starts, which is essentially still a child. So I spent a lot of time trying to get a sense of what their daily life would be like, what sort of vocabulary they would use, what the expectations of them are. It's quite hard writing a romance when most mothers wouldn't let a 17-year-old be alone in a room with a young man. That's the sort of stuff that isn't really in history books. That's the sort of stuff you have to read people's stories to get.
And it is very much a coming-of-age novel.
Yes, yeah. One of the things I was really interested in was how constraining the versions of femininity are. People get quite upset about you putting sort of modern characters into historical books. They say, oh, you know, an Edwardian girl wouldn't have behaved like that. But the emotional response is astonishingly modern. One of the poems that's quoted in the book is from a book called Our Women People, that's sort of feminist poetry. And she has a whole rant about how her clothes don't have pockets in them and how unfair it is that she can't be an engineer or whatever. There's a real sense of women who've been educated. We've had universal education in Britain for a long time. We've had girls who are beginning to want to go to university and things like that. And these educated young women who are living with parents who are essentially raised as Victorians and who are desperate to live a much more modern life. They're desperate to go to university, they're desperate to have careers, they're desperate to be allowed to rent a flat without people thinking they're a lady of ill repute. These are all intelligent young people who are wanting to live fulfilled and productive lives. They would find a path that let them do that.
And as you say, they are all united by their determination to win rights and votes for women. And yet, as we still see nowadays, the women's movement is very divided in how far that rebellion should go and what form it should take.
I think that's a problem that have faced protest movements throughout the age. You know, I mean, you think about Monty Python's text about the people's front of Judea. It's just a bit like that. People get into this because they are furious and passionate and angry, and protesters aren't very good at listening to each other, and that was a problem in the suffrage movement, which had huge numbers of rifts and falling out and fights, and it's a problem in modern protest movements now.
Quite a few of the books on the Philip Carnegie shortlist this year are about young women seeking to find a voice. It does rather indicate that in 100 years we haven't come quite as far as we might hope.
No, that's true. We have come a huge way, though. When I do my school talk, I say to children that the characters in this book, they can't get a degree, they can't rent a room. If they leave their husband, they lose all rights to see their children. They don't have equal pay. Part of the suffrage movement was about using their votes for causes for women, and they said, you know, we will have pay for mothers, pay for disabled people, old age pensions, state orphanages. Women will be able to be lawyers and doctors, and well, with female doctors and female lawyers, but not many of them, female engineers, this kind of stuff. The work that the suffragettes put into motion revolutionised society in a really, really short period of time. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of battles still to fight, the lack of money for women's refuges, for the things that the suffragettes were fighting for children's services, for social services, for disabled, and I mean, these are all caring professions with things that were done in the home or in the workhouse, and it's not quite that extreme nowadays, but it is noticeable that jobs that tend to fall to women are jobs that aren't getting the same financial support from the government. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are definitely battles that need to be fought, but the amount that we've come in 100 years is astonishing, and it happened within about 50 years of women getting the vote.
I know just before we started recording, I was telling you that the audiobook version is already available in the RNIB Talking Books library, which you must be delighted that it's reaching an audience who are otherwise print disabled.
Yes, completely. My mother was a social worker for the blind, so it's an area that I know a little bit about around the edges.
And I believe that your mother also taught Braille.
She did, yes.
And of course, if you win the Philip Carnegie Medal, you will receive a copy of Things a Bright Girl Can Do in Braille.
Oh, wonderful. I didn't know that. That's brilliant. My mother, if I do win, my mother will I'll give that to my mother and she'll be able to read it.
Well, there'd be a certain serendipity in that.
There would, wouldn't there?
Oh, well, Sally Nichols, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I will look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much.
Things a Bright Girl Can Do by Sally Nichols is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB24758. As a girl growing up in Manila, Candy Goulet wondered why none of the books that she read ever resembled her tropical home. So it took her years to fulfill her dream of becoming an author. Her first two novels, Tall Story and Shine, were shortlisted for a host of awards, including the Philip Carnegie Medal. She came to our Camden studio to tell me more. Candy Goulet, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, for those who haven't yet read Bone Talk, can you set the scene?
Well, Bone Talk is set in a place called Bontoc. In fact, the title is how Americans mispronounced Bontoc when they came and invaded the Philippines in 1898. So that's the setting. In 1898, the United States invaded the Philippines. And when you got to the Philippines, Manila was like a Latin city with bullfighting and opera and all that kind of stuff. But just outside were a lot of tribes. And in the mountains were these headhunting tribes. The Bontoc lived in a region somewhere north of Manila. And they were headhunters. And my hero is a little boy who is growing up in this headhunting tribe, has never seen the outside world. And suddenly the Americans arrive and he realizes that the world is not what he thought it was.
And for him, he has assumed as he's growing up that he has known the full extent of the world and he's going to become a warrior in the traditions of his tribe. And there's a line in the book that says he believes that everybody has black hair. So he's rather disconcerted when he sees his first American.
Well, imagine if you'd grown up in a place where everyone has black hair. I grew up in a place where everyone has black hair. And then you meet your first fair-skinned, fair-haired, blue-eyed person. I mean, it must be really quite worrying. And that's what I tried to capture. I mean, I remember, well, I was introduced to the outside world through the magic of TV as a child in the Philippines. But I had never thought that I would live abroad or be myself a foreigner in another place. So my life living here in England, it's 30 years now, has been a constant culture shock and cross-culture, you know, bumping cultures constantly.
And is that why you write historical fiction, that actually it's easier to examine those themes from a distance than close up?
Well, this is the first time I've written a historical novel. My first two novels were contemporary children's fiction, kind of heartwarming, with all of that stuff of culture clash. But this one, I found out about this story and I thought, can I write it? But it was really, really difficult to commit to writing this book because the history is not written by the Bontoc themselves. Most of the history is written by the Americans. And you can imagine, when I started researching it, a lot of the material was so racist and you could not hear the voices of the people who I wanted to write about. So I was very wary of committing to writing the book.
Samkhad's culture is very ritualistic, it's very religious, for want of another word. And next to that, the Americans look like savages, really, as they claim to be bringing civilization to their headhunters, is quite a clash of cultures.
It is. I mean, when you look back at that era, the constant refrain that you heard from the American propaganda, because they had to sell the idea of colonizing the Philippines to the American public. And the way they sold it was that, one, they wanted to Christianize Filipinos. Now, the Philippines was colonized by Spain for 300 years before this, the Americans came. So they were going to Christianize the Catholics. But these people in the mountains were not Christians because the Spanish never managed to get that far. I think they gave the Americans a good reason to continue with the colonization. They had this kind of publicity campaign where they took photographs of the headhunters, and one guy even made a toured America showing off these photographs and saying, this is why America has to be in the Philippines, to save these people, to show them what being civilized is all about.
And it's not only questions of imperialism, but also questions of masculinity that echo down through to our age that you raise in the book as well. Samkhad is a young man and wishes to become a warrior, expects to become a warrior, and yet his best friend, Luki, is just as strong, just as resilient, and because she's a girl, has no hope of becoming a warrior.
Exactly. Growing up in the Philippines when I was a little girl in the 1960s and 70s, there were very fixed ideas about what girls could do and boys could do. And I would look with envy at what my brother was allowed to get away with, whereas I had to behave, I had to act in a certain way, dress in a certain way. And then when I started to dream of doing things, I wanted to act on stage, but I wanted to play the heroes. I didn't want to play those screaming damsels in distress wearing terrible dresses. And I channeled all of that into Luki. I was telling somebody the other day that even if their culture was that old mountain culture from a long, long time ago, I'll bet there were little girls over there who said, why do I have to wear a skirt? Why can't I fight like my brothers are allowed to fight? And I wanted to capture that in the story.
Do you know, I think that's something that will resonate with a lot of blind listeners, that blind characters are only ever cast as stricken victims or sonically superpowered. And it's very frustrating. We're pigeonholed, I think, especially in film and literature.
yes, I think that's a universal experience. Women pigeonholed this way as a writer of color, as a Filipino. When I'm invited to speak in festivals, it's always the diversity panel where I talk about never seeing myself in books. And I'm like, I want to talk about story structure. I want to talk about, you know, all the things that the other writers are allowed to talk about. But I think things are changing now, though. There's such a great awareness of diversity and how people all come from different backgrounds. And we are consciously trying to not make diversity the issue.
I agree. I think diversity is actually a very divisive issue. If we look at how we differ, we'll forget what we've got in common. One question I would like to ask. I know that you're a strong and respected voice in the Black, Asian, minority ethnic world as far as publishing is concerned. And I was wondering if there's anything you feel that we as disabled writers can learn from the progress that's been made in the BAME world over the past decade.
The thing is, it hasn't been over the past decade. The truth is, for 20 years, the publishing industry has been aware of the inequality and the lack of representation of Black ethnic minority voices in publishing. But it's a very slow-moving train, and it's really, really hard to change. Right now, because of a lot of activism in the United States, there are a lot of voices raised. We are talking about it. There are a lot of efforts that have started. But until you really see systemic change, because the problem is not that there is a lack of talent. The problem is there's a lack of access because the system is filled with people who are not aware that that talent exists outside. And also people like me growing up and not seeing myself in books, never seeing a Filipino in books, so much so that when I was a kid, I thought Filipinos were not allowed to be in books. I didn't give myself permission to write stories. And I think that's probably the only advice I would have for disabled people who want to maybe write or participate in the arts. I think you can't wait for permission. Let us just make things and then hold it up and say, here, I made this. What do you think? Try to get it to as many people as possible. Don't wait for someone to pick you and say, hey, you can fill my diversity quota. Don't wait. Make things, get it out there, and hopefully, you know, we'll accelerate the speed with which the world wakes up to the need for diversity.
And I guess actually the dissemination of ideas and writing via the internet, being able to create a forum for your writing and find other people who will be your audience, must have helped empower that as well.
Well, the internet is a powerful tool for raising awareness. But at the end of the day, if you want to write a book, all you can do is sit down and do the time at the laptop. And it took me 9 years to get published. So I did my time. And now, you know, it's really nice being shortlisted for the Costa. I hope it's going to inspire a lot of people who think my story doesn't deserve to be between the pages of a book, because I think every story deserves to be heard.
So, as that young girl growing up in Manila, what were the books that fed your imagination?
Oh, do you know, I was a massive reader. I spent all my time in the school library. But the funny thing about growing up in a place like the Philippines is there was no publishing in the Philippines when I was growing up. It's kind of very telling because now there's a lot of publishing going on. It's a vibrant publishing scene. But when I was a little girl, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there were very, very few books that were published in the Philippines, and especially not children's books. Those were the days when there would be a door-to-door salesman selling encyclopedias, Reader's Digest compilations, and collections of classic books. We bought all of those books. So I read from Collins Junior Classics, that stuff like that. Lots of Enid Blyton. I loved Enid Blyton. I was desperate to know what scones tasted like and what was ginger beer and all of those things. It's kind of like food porn, isn't it, Enid Blyton? There's a lot of talking about tea and stuff. And when I drank my first cup of tea, I was so disappointed. And when I got here and had my first scone, it was like, oh, it's just a bun.
Quite a dry bun at that sometimes.
It's a very dry bun that needs a lot of butter.
Now, I hear that you did a pretty rigorous research effort on this book, that you took yourself off to the mountains. Is that true?
I did. It's not an easy place to get to. You fly to Manila and then there's an 11-hour journey and quite a difficult one to get into the mountains. And then it's quite basic, but it's the most stunning part of the world. It's one of my favorite places in the world. And because I'd written a little bit of the book already by the time I'd gone to the place. So the setting is these mountains that have been carved into rice terraces. So every mountain is carved into steps. And you walk along these very narrow ridges amongst the rice terraces. And I've seen lots of photographs of this place. It's stunning. Everyone takes photos and you see them in tourist brochures and things like that. But when you get there, then you hear the voices of the people working, singing, shouting in the rice paddies, the snorting of the water buffaloes. And then you look in the water and there are snails and fish. There's tiny fish in the rice paddies high up in the mountains and crabs. I mean, that surprised me. The crabs really surprised me. So I had to have a bit in the book where someone was having a fight and when they got up from the mud of the rice terraces, they find crabs in their hair.
And does much of Samkhad and Luki's civilization remain there still?
The arrival of the Americans completely changed that society. If you go there, you will still see people. They still sing their songs. They dress in their costumes. But the Americans succeeded in Christianizing the people there. So all over the Philippines, you will find Catholics. But up in the mountains, you will find Episcopalians. And when I tried to ask them, because one of the difficulties of writing the story was writing from the perspective of somebody who believes what they believe. They were animists. So I had to speak from their point of view. And I didn't know what did an animist believe. How was I supposed to write this voice? And I went up to the mountains and interviewed several people asking them, what was it like? And they don't know. They don't remember. And I had to piece it all together, reading anthropological texts that dated even back to the Spanish era. But I hope I've captured it. I don't know if I have. I had to fill in the gaps. So there's a lot of fictional imagination in the way the world is constructed and the religion is constructed.
Was there a tree of bones where the title comes from?
Yes, well, there really is a tree. So every community will have a tree, and they call it the Patayan. And at the end of every village, you will see it's a cluster of trees or a large tree. And that was where they performed a lot of rituals. I just took the extra step of making mine a tree of bones. Because I noticed when I visited homes in the mountains that they continued to practice some of their rituals, which involved a lot of animals sacrifice. And they would keep the bones. So I would go into someone's house and from the rafters, you would see chicken bones and water buffalo bones. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to hang the bones from a tree and call the tree of bones. And when the wind blows, they can hear the voices of their ancestors speaking to them.
I know at the moment the book is out in hardback with a paperback on the way. Are there plans for an audiobook version?
Oh, I'd love there to be an audiobook version. We're just beginning. You know, it only got published in August, so hopefully, fingers crossed.
In the meantime, I know that you've very kindly offered to read a passage out so that the listeners can get an idea of the power of your writing.
I would love to. So this is a scene in which Samkhad discovers that he's not allowed to become a man yet, and he blames his dad. I ran clumsily, catching my elbows on the corners of houses, stubbing my toes on stones and dislodging small boulders that rolled and bounced ahead of me on the downward path as if they were racing me to the mossy forest. As I dived into the trees, I could hear the distant murmur of the tree of bones. Perhaps the spirits were discussing what had happened. Perhaps they were agreeing that I did not deserve to become a man. Kind spirits, I called into the trees. It was just a mistake. A soft breeze brushed against my cheek, and the tree of bones chattered louder. Mother, help me, I cried. Tell them Father didn't mean it. The chatter continued. If you know Father did not mean it, why did you tell on him? Mother, I whispered, are you listening? the chattering stopped. Had Mother Spirit managed to persuade our other ancestors to spare me? There was a flicker of movement behind a large tree. A low noise. Something between a throat clearing and a grunt. The sound hardened as if it came from a throat filled with sharp stones. A wild boar! Slowly, slowly, I turned round, trying to spot the beast hiding in the trees. Nothing stirred in the undergrowth, though the grunting continued. I could feel it watching me, waiting for its chance to attack and gouge me with its tusks. Tambul once told me all I had to do in case of a boar attack was to punch the boar hard between its tiny eyes, and it would turn around and run in the opposite direction. I stared at my fists. They looked like pebbles on the ends of sticks. The grunting became even louder, shriller. I frowned. It sounded like... Was that giggling? Little Luki, I roared. There she was, on a branch right above my head, bouncing up and down with a massive grin on her face. She had taken off her skirt and put on a breechcloth like mine. If her hair had been cut above her brow instead of tucked behind her ears, she would have looked exactly like a boy. "You know, you ought to stop calling me little," she laughed. "I'm the same size as you now." I scowled. "The ancients are going to bury you under an ant's nest when they see what you're wearing." "They can't see me now, can they?" "Nobody can." Luki blithely slid down the tree. "You try wearing a skirt, Samkad, and see if you like it." She folded her arms across her chest. "So, tell me what's going on." Everyone in the village could hear the yelling.
Candy Gourlay reading from her novel Bone Talk. That was beautiful, Candy. Have you considered that maybe you could narrate the book yourself?
Oh, I'd love to be asked.
Well, I think all the listeners will be able to hear that it's both a very powerful and a very entertaining book. And I, for one, will be keeping my fingers crossed that an audiobook version will be made. In the meantime, I wish you the very best of luck with the Costa Book Award. And I very much hope to speak to you in the not too distant future.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Bone Talk by Candy Gourlay is out now in print and ebook, wherever you buy your books. Let's hope that an audio version will be on its way soon. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail. That's REDSZELL. And producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.